now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker for the session, Dr. Michael Gilman. Round of applause. Yay. All right. Dr. Gilman was one of the first in the country to perform outpatient total joints beginning in 2011 and has started programs at three different facilities. Dr. Gilman is vice chairman at La Vida Surgical Center, the busiest by volume in the SCA partnership in the country with three facilities, 15 ORs, and 21,000 procedures performed in 2023. So again, Dr. Gilman, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you. Lexi, Claire, Adam, the whole OR manager team, I think you guys deserve a round of applause too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for everybody for attending this and sharing your afternoon with me. I see some champagne and I'm impressed that you're here after that champagne in the auditorium there. So the goal today is hopefully in the next 45 to 60 minutes to help you guys become advocates, if you're not already, for doing as many joint replacements in an outpatient setting in your hospital or ASC as we possibly can. And we'll go through why that's important and how you can help. So this in a nutshell, the quadruple aim, a lot of people are familiar with the triple aim, quality outcomes, cost of care, patient experience, but the quadruple aim also includes provider experience, nurse, physician, staff, and I think you can make an argument they're equally important. In my mind, I think the patient experience part of doing surgeries in the outpatient surgery setting and also the provider experience is really a win. My proudest accomplishments, not on this slide, I have a autistic son who has overcome that over the last 20 years, and another son with glioblastoma who's 15 years out from his chemotherapy. So I've, of the mantra, I live every day is a good day, and I hope you guys, with whatever you have in your lives, bring that to what you're doing for our patients. As mentioned, I do oversee about 100 surgeons and 30 orthopedic surgeons at SCA's biggest, I think by volume still, facility in the country. And I became interested in outpatient joint replacements a long time ago in 2011. That was before we had good anesthesia blocks and before there were, you know, tranexamic acid medicine for helping to prevent blood flow. So it was a little scarier time to be doing that. And at that time, there were maybe one or two dozen of us in the country. We were kind of considered cowboys. And that kind of continued to be the story. There was a lot of lag in doing these procedures outpatient until COVID, as we all know, out of necessity, you know, we had to move these to our outpatient facilities. This is a disclaimer. This is meant to encourage discussion and consideration to doing these in an ambulatory setting. Ultimately, it really depends on having an informed patient and a compelling reason for why they want to have these procedures done in the outpatient setting, and a conversation with their care provider team, and also up to the surgeon to depend on who is appropriate and who is not. And early, if you have providers that are a little bit on the fence for doing these, you know, you want to start with your healthiest patients. And then over time, as you become more comfortable with that, it's very easy and doable for a lot of ASA Category 3 patients to be done safely in a surgery outpatient setting. The history of this procedure, Dr. Berger was truly the pioneer, and he published 50 patients in 2005 that he had safely done in an outpatient setting. He followed that up in 2009 with a study of 121 patients, 86 of whom were done as an outpatient. The readmission rate at that time was quite high. It was 3.6%, but it compared favorably to the Medicare readmission rate of 5 to 6%. That rate for us is now less than 1%, and if you're doing these, you really want to focus on four key points with either nursing support or your team support. The four main drivers of readmission to the hospital, one is inadequate pain control, one is concerns about bleeding and patients that may become hypotensive, a third is urinary issues, and a fourth is nausea. And so we really proactively try to manage those things before and after the surgery. Patients are reassured that bleeding is a normal part of the process and that they should be hydrating well. On the nausea front, We want to make sure that they have access to one or up to three medications if they're having a nausea event. You really want to be either on the physician side or as a nurse who's managing these patients, proactive in getting the calls before they go to the emergency room with clear instructions for if they're having issues to call you. The urinary issue, we've become more liberal at straight cathing the patients before they go home if they're not able to urinate, and instructing them to return to get help if they're 8 hours after that, and starting to use Flomax in the male population for those patients that are middle-aged routinely who may have urinary issues. And then the last issue, the multimodal pain management issue. So, narcotics have kind of gotten a bad rap, and we're trying to minimize their use. But at the same time, for those patients that need them, in the first 5 days, you want to be liberally giving them, if they need it, oxycodone or hydromorphone. And we supplement that with gabapentin or pregabalin. And also, there's some good recent studies with duloxetine, which can help. So I think this is a critical slide for why we all really need to focus on doing more of these and as many of these as we can in an outpatient setting. This estimation for how many more joint replacements is really ballooned, and we're estimating a 330% increase in hips and a 382% increase in knees. And out of interest, I've also listed the revision numbers, and there are some facilities now that are being more liberal in doing revision procedures in outpatient settings too. I don't know how many of you are old enough in the room to have liked the $6 million man, but I think this mantra is correct: better, stronger, faster. With our implants, we want to see operational efficiency improvement. We want to see cost improvement, and we'd like to have our patients be as satisfied as possible, and that really is key, and we'll focus a lot on the patient satisfaction as part of this talk. So some people want to know how many of these can we safely do as, outpatients, and for those patients that I'm nervous about, I'll still do them in the hospital setting. But I would estimate that, even the higher risk people, the older patients, if they have adequate support at home and they're doing well, we very often send them home same day and, no more than 23 hours most of the time. I think there's a little bit of a conflict with some employed physicians because some hospitals still have gain-sharing programs, and there's a little bit of a financial disincentive to some degree in some of these gain-sharing programs. I do have a bonus topic. If I don't get to structuring physician equity, I'm happy to have offline conversations with anybody that may want to have that after the talk. So I think we get to where we want to be with better messaging from everyone in this room that the surgery done as an outpatient is actually safer. And the Hippocratic Oath for doctors is essentially do no harm. And that's what I think about. Cost can be of harm to the patient. It's not really discussed much. There's not a lot of price transparency. But for most patients, the cost of having this done as an outpatient is significantly lower. We don't really have a good estimation for how many patients are given the opportunity to be in the hospital and they decline because they can't afford whatever their premium might be or copayment may be. I think the easiest way to help to make this common sense for a patient is the infection risk. Infection can cause very serious harm, as all of us who know doing joint replacement. You're looking at least one and more often two additional surgical procedures and a very prolonged recovery. And I'm very blatant with patients who want to go to skilled nursing care with all the risk of getting an iatrogenic infection at skilled nursing. You're really, especially for knees, putting your leg at risk. And, fortunately, I think I've had one amputation in 25 years. But that is a legitimate concern with infections, and we want to try to minimize whatever we can do in that regard. Team burnout, not just surgeon burnout, and limited resources also can cause harm. And I think most of us are more productive as teams when we're doing these as outpatients, whether that's in the hospital or the ASC. In terms of cost, there's not a lot of data, but a Journal of Arthroplasty article in 2018 showed that the overall cost across the country was about $8,500 less for outpatient joint replacement, and another study about 30% less costly. There was a specific hip study done that showed about $5,000 less cost per quality-adjusted life year in an outpatient type of procedure. A more recent study showed that there's a higher margin, you know, since Medicare went to the inpatient only for majority of these patients, that the hospital and the surgery center both, there's a higher net margin for doing it this way. There are some socioeconomic concerns, the last reference there for you. And then some of that may be just educational, that we're not getting patients ready as well before the surgery. And I think that that's a critical element. We need to be educating our patients better, doing these as outpatient, and making sure they're really up to date before we do them, as opposed to watching them as inpatients. I'd like to just briefly mention cancellations. Cancellations, as you all know, are really painful. Painful because you can't always rebook at that same date, and it's also not good for the surgeon who, you know, typically has 4 to 6 weeks of waiting, can't easily move a patient last minute. That being said, an outpatient procedure, the cost of filling that time is easier than it is as an inpatient. A 2016 study showed that about one cancellation happens every 13 operative days, largely due to cardiac and pulmonary. So if you have those patients that you're screening, you want to make sure that those things are addressed well in advance if they have any issues at a substantial cost, about $9,400 per Medicare patient. So I think we all know intuitively that infections are lower in the surgery center than in the hospital. And our facilities, our three facilities, with 23,000 procedures, last year we had 5 documented infections, which is mind-boggling, much, much lower than in the hospital. I work at a top 50 orthopedic hospital in Laguna Beach, and our infection rate is low, but it's more in the, you know, 1 to 1.5% range. So there is a very compelling argument to make to patients that we're doing these as outpatients, you're going home, you're not on the floor with the other infections that are in the hospital that may be disastrous for you. There's not really any direct studies, but I challenge you to just ask your surgeons, especially the ones that are doing a lot of procedures in both, and I think you'll get unanimous feedback that the infection rate is lower in the ASC or outpatient setting. I think it's really important for patient satisfaction. You know, this is, for some of you that stopped by our booth, I'm going to talk about our app in a little while. Our Medicare patient payments are at risk now. It's mandatory in the hospital. It's voluntary in the ASC right now, but within the year probably will become mandatory, that we need to engage our patients, make sure they're satisfied. I think the surgery center setting is able to do that. You know, you have more, I think, nursing support and help, follow-up phone calls, a joint navigator who can really be the contact for the joint replacement patient. So I think that just that engagement alone leads to a higher patient satisfaction than otherwise would be the case. What you may or may not know is one of the requirements that the government is imposed, and I call this a stealth requirement because it's amazing to me how many people are unaware of this requirement that we're talking to at the meeting today. You know, about 3% of our Medicare payments are at risk, not just for orthopedic joint replacements, but if you're not submitting your joint replacement scores, I encourage you to talk to your leadership at your hospitals to see if they know about this requirement, because all of the Medicare payments, Part A, are at risk across multiple specialties, cardiac, urology, and otherwise, if you're not submitting the scores. And I think in developing our app, what we've really found to be very challenging is you have to be able to get your post-op outcome scores 300 to 425 days after that procedure. And the good news, bad news, you know, the vast majority of our knee and hip replacement patients are so happy that you may never see them after 3 months or 6 months. And so it's important, I think, to have them engaged in some platform that makes it easier, that you have to be able to collect 50% of that data at that 300 to 425 day time frame after the procedure, and that's challenging. Next, I'd like to move into net promoter scores. Some of you may be using this, some of you may not. Our surgery centers use this for two main reasons. We use it for the surgeons that are using the facility to see how well the management and surgical care affiliates is performing, how we might improve that, but also, more importantly, for the patients and hopefully knowing that patients are leaving happy. The way that you calculate this net promoter score, the number of promoters subtracting the number of detractors and dividing that by the total number of responses. And to be a promoter, you really have to be in that 9 to 10 range. Somebody who is a 7 to 8 may or may not be giving you positive feedback, and a detractor, somebody that's potentially harmful to your patient satisfaction scores, is in the 0 to 6 range. So if we look at just what's been published in the literature about net promoter scores, there's room for improvement. So patients that have primary joint replacements typically are in the 66% of them would undergo the procedure again, which was surprisingly low to me. And then the latter group in the revision group, of course, we know those patients are challenging and not as happy. And fortunately, the government is not, for those people that are doing their hip and knee replacements, they do exclude fractures and revisions. So we're just talking about primary joints being required for that data. Our facility has done well with net promoter scores from the patient standpoint, very close to that 9 number out of 10. The surgeon responses we get, not just what is their promoter score, but also we like to get comments about what is working and what isn't working. And we try to address that if we can. It doesn't have to be anonymous, but we encourage them to leave their name so we can follow up with them and try to make sure that the surgeons are happy, because talking to some of you over the weekend, and we know too, is you have unhappy surgeons and they're going elsewhere. So we want to keep an eye on the net promoter scores for the surgeons and address their issues too. So I think we all know post-COVID, this, I think, is a critical element of the quadruple aim. Staff burnout is really painful, and it's led to a lot of procedural problems with having, in our Providence hospitals, appropriate staffing to run the rooms that we have available. And that's driven by a really large number of people that have just quietly quit or outright quit. And that number is surprisingly high. 18% of healthcare workers have quit, and 20 to 50% state that they're thinking of quitting, which is really high. Burnout has also been looked at, a very high number there. Depression, significantly high. So whatever we can do as teams and facilities to promote mental health and well-being is really important. This slide comes from the American Academy of Hip and Knee Surgeons. What you may or may not know is there's been a dramatic decline over the period of the last 30 years in what surgeons have been getting for their procedures. These average listed procedures include not just the surgical procedure, but the 90 days of care after the surgical procedure. And one of the easy points, if you're trying to get your surgeons in the hospital or the ambulatory setting to really do more of these as outpatients, is you can closely follow up your patients with calls day 1, 2, and 3. Rounding is a time-consuming effort for either the surgeon, physician assistant, or whoever may be helping. And so it really, I think, helps to convey that message. And unfortunately, because the pricing has gone down, surgeons have to be more operationally efficient to maintain their traditional incomes. So that's, again, where if you have a good setup in your hospital or ambulatory setting, you may or may not have a second room to flip cases. But there's a reason why the surgeons are really focused on efficiency and why doing these as an outpatient is a win. Next, the Advantages of outpatient joints: improved operational efficiency, less hospital work, happier patients, better quality staff. I think a lot of the senior nursing team in the room, you gravitate towards the ambulatory setting, predictable hours, high quality people. And I think the hospitals have more younger nurses who have that energy level and can stay up all night. But as a surgeon, you know, the surgery center is a great place to be because the nurses are very capable, experienced, and you know, great members of our team. And the last thing I will mention is, you know, the physicians who, I just showed you that reimbursement slide, but depending on your facility and the structure of your partnership, you know, a physician potentially can earn the same amount of money, more or less, by having some equity ownership in the entity. Our surgery center has 30 orthopedic providers, and the two of us that are busy with joint replacements are the top two in that, in terms of revenue generated. And so a surgeon that's bringing about 100 average joints will generate revenue in excess of your busiest sports medicine doctors. So that's something to keep in mind. So going from good to better to best, patient-reported outcomes. Key is educating that patient, giving them as much information as they need to be successful. We have, as many do, preoperative classes. We also offer one-on-one time. If you have an elderly patient, I think it's really important to have a trusted family member be a second set of ears in whatever meeting and phone call who's going to be giving that patient support at home for the first few days. We like to use the term white glove service. As you also know, probably with your outpatient departments in the hospital and at the ASC, we tend to have higher nursing levels than traditionally in the hospital for inpatients. So that I think is a good, you know, selling point if you need to sell the patient. And then I think it's also critical for whatever concerns come up post-op that you have immediate access to someone, surgeon, nurse, or both, to address those, to reassure those patients that everything's okay, and to make an action plan, like I talked about, for the nausea or the pain or the urinary issues, whatever it may be. So next, I'd like to move into implementation of the patient-reported outcome measures. This is a new mandatory measure in hospitals and will be mandatory soon for the ambulatory centers. It is meeting or exceeding a substantial clinical benefit. We have to have a 50% reporting rate, and we need to have resources. We analyze this in our surgery center and have about a need for a 1 to 2 extra person FTE requirement. When you get a chance to look at the website that we have, you can kind of put in there the number of procedures you're doing and whether you appreciate it or not, what that looks like to your nursing team for what they're investing with their time and energy. And arguably, in my estimation, they can spend their time on plenty of other things that they have to do. So this puts more pressure on us as caregivers. You have to be not just a nurse or part of the team, but data collecting and dealing with accounting. And there are stresses placed on us that we otherwise would not have with this new requirement. Again, a stealth requirement that most people don't know about, with 3% of your annual payment update at risk. This is for fee-for-service Part A claims across all specialties. And that 25% annual payment update is about a 3% number. The other things that are critically important, though, that I would encourage you to talk about with your management at your facilities is you're disqualified from the Medicare Value Purchasing Program if you're not meeting what they want you to meet here. And there are year-over-year compounded losses, any losses carried forward that you might have in year one. There are increased labor costs that we talked about, data and reporting processes. The other thing that is potentially of reputational risk is they're going to be publishing these data to the community, and whether you like it or not, you hopefully need to perform well here because your community is going to know about it. increased staffing demands, and reporting. So we came up with this platform that essentially allows patients to do the vast majority of the work with this process. Basic demographic data is inputted. The facility administration schedules the procedure. And from that point, the patients get automated texts and emails to complete their HOOS and COOS hip and knee junior scores and surveys. And it's important not just that those surveys are completed, but with the post-operative data, you have to be showing a 20-plus point improvement in those scores. So we've automated how that's calculated, and then we push hard at the end to get their post-operative data. So as you can see here, it goes into more detail. You have to be with the WHO score 22 points improvement is the substantial clinical benefit threshold to be eligible. And for the knee score, you have to be 20 points improved and that 50% threshold. The numerator is the risk-adjusted proportion of the patients that are undergoing the elective procedure and meeting that those thresholds on the HOOS and COOS scores. And then the denominator are those enrolled in Medicare fee-for-service Part A 12 months prior to the date of the index procedure, those that are 65 or older, those that are discharged alive, and then the elective primary and not the revisions and not the fractures. Financial penalty we talked about, the labor costs, and the increased staffing. So this is a standalone app that takes a lot of your time and energy out of the equation. We basically have rapid enrollment with just basic demographics that your clinical staff can do, scheduling and inputting the surgery date, and then a lot of auto alerts that go out to the patient. We get asked about, well, what if we don't have an older patient that can't deal with the tech? I think most people can just click on a link that they're texted, but that's another good reason to have ask the question about who in their family might be able to help them afterwards, because those patients are in the loop. I'm sorry, those family members are in the loop, and they can be included in this. That 50% capture rate is really difficult. So this basically is an engaging platform, email, text, archiving. And then at the end of the year, you have to upload the data to the government do that, and it's a very easy one-step process. The facilities, nurse managers do have access to the data. You can see who has not replied, but it's easy to navigate. This is helpful for the staffing, the admin, doctors and patients. Doctors get real-time dashboards, so they also know if there's a problem. Prior to doing the procedure in the pre-op holding area, it's a 5-minute process for the patient to do that. After they're enrolled, pre-op, post-op survey, staff data. Templates and scoring, a little bit hard to read, but the HOOS and the COOS, if you're not familiar with those surveys, are basically pain and function. Can you get up out of a chair? Are you doing stairs? And then other function, and whether or not you're improving by 20 points, 22 points for hip and knee. This is a sample of a score. How severe is your knee stiffness? Pain twisting and pivoting on your knee? Pain straightening your leg, going up or down stairs, standing upright, getting up from a sitting position, and bending or picking things up off the floor. Emails and reminders, talked about that. I'm not going to go into the nitty and gritty, but otherwise you can have access to the raw data and see it. And here's just an average example. I don't know if anybody in the room knows what your Medicare Part A reimbursements are, but we do have a tool on our website that you can enter, whatever that may be, if your leadership is interested. And kind of, you know, I think it's somewhat shocking to me that some of the bigger systems that are at this meeting really have no awareness of this. It, like I said, it's a stealth. We're going to take 3% of your money if you're not doing it, and they haven't really publicized it. So I would encourage you to make sure that your leadership is aware of what's going on and that they have a plan. But you can enter what that number looks like and what you're at risk of losing. You can also enter how many surgeons you have and how many procedures you're doing a year, and you get a calculation for what that looks like for your nursing team and for those nurses in the room that feel like you're overwhelmed and stressed. I think you can make a compelling argument to get more help if you are going to do this on your own. You get a good estimation for what that cost and time looks like, so maybe your admin is more receptive to supporting you. Okay, so take-home points. Outpatient total joint fulfills the quadruple aim. We're striving for high net promoter scores because of this patient-reported outcome measure. We really need to focus on patient satisfaction with what we're doing and all of our contacts with our patients. The outcomes is a time and a cost challenge. I do have some time now. I'd like to, have questions at the end, but I had a couple of other bonus topics. I was hoping to talk about robotics some and also some of the surgeon equity here. I'll go back to that. So robotics is a hot topic in joint replacement. By show of hands, how many of you have robotics for orthopedics in your systems? That's a lot. Yeah, a lot. So, you know, it's unclear for a lot of systems whether this is a moneymaker or not. It does encourage the ability to promote, so you may be getting some additional cases from that promotion. And it's nice for young surgeons, I think, who are trying to grow their practice, who don't really have a reputation in the community, but patients do like hearing that my surgeon is using the robot. That being said, most of the studies that have been done show that experienced surgeons, there's not really a clear clinical benefit from using those robots. And whether it's the Stryker robot, the Zimmer robot, Smith & Nephew robot, they all cost a lot of money. And sometimes that money is spread across other buys that you have in your hospital. But it seems clear to me that the manufacturers are doing quite well. Whether the hospitals have a higher net margin or not, I'm not sure. And in 10 to 20 years, I don't know where we're going to be with robotics. But for now, there is enthusiasm with them. There's also, for the surgery center, if you're trying to do more of these in the ambulatory surgery center, most of them are large, and if you're trying to do two rooms, there's a little bit of logistics. Unless you want to own two robots, that's expensive. And if you're trying to make this as efficient as possible for the surgeons, it may be challenging to do that with a robot. Some of the concerns, I hit on those. If you get pushback from patients, it used to be that we were more concerned about transfusions. Some of the surgeons that you may want to recruit to be doing more of these as an outpatient, the transfusion risk is about 99% less since we started using tranexamic acid. So that's not really, in my mind, a big concern at this point. I think there are also concerns of surgeons that have been doing these as inpatients for so long that they're just more comfortable with that. And if you're trying to convey that the hospital margin or the surgery center margin is important, I think you can have honest discussions with surgeons about how they may benefit from not having to round, how their patients may be just fine with daily phone calls after the fact, and how their patients may benefit from having, you know, great education prior to the procedure. The equipment sterilization concerns are a legitimate issue for some ASCs. I think that the space issue is an issue, but our growth has been not hindered by the requirement for sterilization, and most of the manufacturer companies, if you ask them to come in with two or three sets of instruments, They're happy to do that if your surgery center is challenged and you have a lineup of several cases in the same room on that particular day. Surgeon equity, I think, you know, hospitals, I think, are more receptive to this now than they used to be. Gain sharing has been popular, and that's been extended. The federal allowance for that is extended year to year. I think in a longer term situation, trying to figure out a way where a surgeon can be a part of that, I think, is a very compelling argument to that surgeon. And again, with the productivity being very high relative to sports medicine and other specialties, that it's prudent to try to engage those surgeons in conversations where they can be a part of the equity piece that may, you know, be an equal amount of reimbursement to what they're taking home from doing the procedures. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have or discuss.
We're recorded.
We got microphones.
So we have microphones.
Do you raise your hand? Okay. I'm seeing things. Oh, yeah, I got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Are most surgeons coming out being robotically trained? I know general surgeons pretty much are, but I didn't know about orthopedics.
Yes, I think the majority are robotically trained. They're trained without the robot too, but the enthusiasm is because a young surgeon in a community doesn't really have a reputation. They're trying to build their reputation, and robotics is a good buzzword. And frankly, I'll tell you, I have a young associate who's been in practice 5 years, and he has grown his practice. He is, for the non-Medicare patients, he's charging his patients for the privilege of him using the robot a fee of $1,000. He's not disclosing that they can come to one of his partners and not have that fee, but it's been a bonus that he's been capitalizing on. Whether you consider that to be ethical or not, I have a hard time with the published studies not really showing there to be a clinical benefit with people that do that, but so be it.
Dr. Gilman, you mentioned the 3% penalty for noncompliance in reporting. Is there an additional penalty for infection, for post-op infection?
You know, so within 90 days for Medicare patients, so if you have a hip dislocation or if you have an infection, that's already kind of been present where you're not necessarily going to get paid for going back to the 90-day. If you hit that 90-day mark, that's kind of the critical element. So a second procedure within that time frame is not necessarily reimbursable. But I don't believe there's any penalty for that, just that you're not going to get paid for that. I believe so, yeah.
I have a question about the surveys, the COOS and the HOOS. Do they have to be reported at the patient level to CMS?
Yes, they do.
Okay, so it's not just in aggregate for the
ANC? No, it's individual patient. And there is a risk. Somebody had asked me earlier on the floor, they are allegedly going to be amenable to risk-adjusted reporting. So if you have, you know, more cardiac patients or whatever it may be, they're supposedly going to look at that.
Thank you. Are you seeing alternate procedures such as lateral knees, anterior hips, bilaterals being performed in ASCs?
So if I understand your question, if you're doing a lateral release at the time of the knee replacement or you're doing bilaterals, mm-hmm. I don't believe that bilaterals are excluded from this reporting requirement. That's a good question because you would expect those patients not to do as well. Mm-hmm. But probably by that 10 to 12 month mark, they do as well. But that's a good question. I don't believe that they're separating out for those additional procedures.
Thank you.
All right, other questions?
Going once.
Am I blind?
Oh, there's one
hi.
In the front.
I'm coming.
No, we're recording, so it really needs to be on a mic.
I got you.
Thank you. Do you run into any roadblocks with anesthesia and criteria?
You know, our outpatient surgery center our relatively new anesthesia director, I was routinely doing patients with BMIs in the 45 to 50 range without any incident. Not those that had sleep apnea, those would be done at the hospital. But there is, in the last several months, a couple of publications and best practices from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons that you really don't want to be doing these people with BMIs that are higher than 40. You know, I kind of have a problem with that because I've had plenty of patients that just can't lose weight, even with the newer medicines, and they do well. But our medical director has kind of put a hard cut on that BMI of 40.
Oh, I'm coming.
Do your freestanding ASCs have a 23-hour unit capability?
We do, and surprisingly, like the first 5 years or so, I think it was maybe 50-50 that we'd keep overnight, but we really just rarely do that. I would say in a year, maybe there's one patient, because they're counseled, we're going to get you up and walking. That's the other key component to this, by the way, physical therapy. You may or may not have physical therapy support, but our nurses are very good, even if it takes two nurses. Those patients are up and walking as soon as their spinal might wear off. And I would say about 80% of patients are getting spinals and about 20% are LMAs. But a key component is getting that patient up and walking and feeling safe that they can use the bathroom before they go home.
So staffing that, I'm assuming it's an on-call, like staffing
23-hour? Yes, correct.
Do you have any criteria for like when the last patient needs to be out, like at 3 or 4?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So we rarely will do these, you know, after 2 p.m. because of the standard staffing that we have. And but we'll start. I have a 6 a.m. cut time, and we, you know, make it happen where if you have a surgeon that has 6 to 8 of these, that they get 2 rooms and they can get out of there before the staff have to, you know, do overtime. That's a legitimate concern. And so, and also we have, you all may have too, but we have productivity data for each surgeon by minute and what their average amount of time is per joint. So the slower guys in particular may be told earlier in the day than otherwise.
All right, great questions, y'all. Anybody else?
Yeah, I did.
Going once, going twice, questions? All right, well, this has been a great discussion, everybody. Just another round of applause for our wonderful speaker, Dr. Gilman.
Thank you. Thanks.